headlines. Prominent Nigerian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki says that the recent deadly crackdown on the Arba'een March in Abuja was not justified. North Korea's leader rejects as a facade the U.S. offer of talks, citing Washington's continued military threats against Pyongyang. Also, the UK government is set to deploy military tanker drivers as panic buying drives petrol pumps and drives up prices. We'll have a report from London. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, prominent Nigerian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki says the 2014 massacre in the northern city of Zaria was a pre-planned crackdown by the government.
What happened in Zaria in 2014 was a pre-planned crackdown, even though they have no way to justify what they did, except because they were so confused as to say that there was blockage of road.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Zakzaki said as many as 1,200 people were killed in the carnage, and many more were injured. The cleric noted that the Zaria massacre was the worst of its kind, but opened the eyes and ears of the people. Zakzaki also said the recent deadly crackdown on the Arba'een March in the capital Abuja was not justified. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zakzaki said the people of his country will opt for an Islamic democracy if given the choice.
We want democracy, isn't it? What is the meaning of the democracy? It is a government of the people. I believe that if there will be a plebiscite in this country where people will be asked, which system would you like? Is it the status quo, which is the heritage of the British colonialists, or the Islamic system? Just cast vote on one of them. I'm sure a majority will choose Islam.
Zakzaki said Nigerian authorities fear of the influence of the Islamic movement in the country. However, he added, they have nothing to fear as the people are after a democratic system. While condemning deadly violence, the cleric underlined that the persecution of Muslims in Nigeria started many years ago. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zakzaki stressed that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran had a, quote, tremendous impact on his ideology. He also expressed hope that the oppression of Palestinian people by the Israeli regime will come to an end. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have held funeral prayers for one of their 8 members killed by the Nigerian security forces. Danjuma Abdullahi has the details of the event held in Abuja, the Nigerian capital.
The funeral prayers for one of the 8 members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the 8 were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'een, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.
They kill about 8 people, which we are sure that now, as they used to do normally, after they kill, they will carry the dead body away. So also the same thing yesterday. They carried away the dead bodies. 8. It is only one of our Muslim brothers by name Shamsuddin Abdurrahman we were able to take away from them.
The Nigerian police have denied that any member was killed during what they described as a provocative trek. Press TV visited a health facility where many injured victims of the attack were receiving treatment from bullet wounds. Members of the Islamic movement have continued to express outrage at the persistent attacks by security forces whenever they come out for religious events.
The security agent in Nigeria, they have been paid. They paid their salary and they provide them with weapons to protect the life and properties of the citizens. But in these days, they are using these weapons to attack the citizens that they are supposed to protect. Our offense to the government of this country is just coming out to show, to practice our religion the way we understand it.
In a statement, Amnesty International has expressed grave concern over the murder of the 8 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. It called on the Nigerian authorities to put an end to the deadly crackdown on members of the Islamic movement, which it says has been going on since December 2015. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has met with the U.S. National Security Advisor to reportedly discuss plans to end the war on Yemen. The Saudi media reported that the kingdom's initiatives include a comprehensive ceasefire under U.N. supervision and the opening of Sana'a International Airport for flights to and from selected locations. Saudi Arabia has launched a devastating war and imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others. It has also plunged the impoverished nation into an economic crisis, triggering food shortages there. The UN has already described the situation in Yemen as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. Political analyst E. Michael Jones says that Washington cannot subsidize the Saudi war on Yemen any longer.
The Saudis have no army. Okay, they have a lot of money, so they buy a lot of expensive equipment, but it just means that they can attack people from the air and they can't follow up. And so the United States has decided it's over. We can't keep go on subsidizing this any longer, even with all the purchase of expensive weapons. They don't want another Afghanistan situation where they're going to be there for 20 years. And so he's going to go and he's going to read them the Riot Act, say we're leaving, and then tell them to basically twist bin Salman's arm and tell them to make peace. They believe that the air war is successful, and they just ignore the failures like North Korea, Vietnam, so on and so forth. And the other thing is that Trump wanted to sell them a lot of expensive equipment. Mm. And the military-industrial complex profits from this. But, you know, at a certain point, it's counterproductive. They wasted billions of dollars in Afghanistan. The military contractors got their money out. At a certain point, it just becomes counterproductive, and they leave. And I think 7 years, they're talking 7 years is long enough. They don't want to go to another 20-year operation because they're more concerned about China at this point. That is the main concern of the United States. It's Eastern Asia, not Western Asia.
North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has rejected as facade the U.S. offer of talks, saying it is a cover for hostile policy. Kim says U.S. military threats against North Korea have remained in place under the administration of Joe Biden. Kim was reacting to a top U.S. envoy who said North Korea's missile launches are a threat to the region, but they would not stop Washington from pursuing a diplomatic path forward. The North Korean leader also expressed willingness to restore inter-Korean hotlines as of October. Kim said it is up to South Korea to continue standoff or foster new relations. He noted that Pyongyang has no reason to provoke or hurt Seoul. We have on the line Jennifer Chang, our correspondent, who is joining us out of Seoul. So on the one hand, we have North Korea test-firing missiles, the most recent of which the hypersonic missile, and on the other we have South Korea and the U.S. holding joint military drills. Can you explain to us what's going on there?
Well, we now have an arms race going on here in Northeast Asia that is extremely rapid because this newest hypersonic missile tested by North Korea is a game changer here in the military equation. That's because this missile can travel at 1 mile per second, 20 times faster than sound, and also steered, so that it can evade all missile defenses on Japan and on South Korea, which are the U.S.'s two main allies, where 80,000 U.S. troops are stationed to deter North Korea from a military attack. And the North is saying that the reason they have these hypersonic missiles they are testing now as one of their top priorities is because they have to defend themselves against a U.S. preemptive nuclear strike, for instance. So we have a very dangerous arms race escalating here in the Korean Peninsula. Now, the U.S. is refusing to withdraw its arms and its troops from in and around the Korean Peninsula, and the North says that as long as this hostile policy continues, it will have to continue to develop its self-defense. That means testing more hypersonic missiles. And eventually, they will get to the point where they can strike Seoul and with great accuracy. So this means that unless the U.S. and South Korea can do something to stop North Korea, that the North Koreans are solidifying their status as a nuclear power. So far, the U.S. and South Korea have not been able to do anything about the North. South stopped short of calling this missile test a provocation. And that means that the South is very compromising toward the North. That is why the North is offering peace, these peace talks, these hotlines to be restored. But it remains for the U.S. to withdraw its hostile policy. Now, the North has said that the Biden administration is even more cunning than previous U.S. administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. It is continuing the hostile policy of sanctions on North Korea, which North Korea says is against its right to self-defense, its right to test weapons that the U.S. and South Korea are also testing. And this whole imbroglio is not going to be solved until the U.S. really thinks about withdrawing its troops from the Korean Peninsula and its military arms from the U.S., Japan, and its base in Guam, areas near South Korea, which constitute a military threat against the North.
Jennifer, what do we know about the U.S. offer of talks, which Kim Jong-un rejects as a facade, and he has said that it's only a cover for hostile policy?
The U.S. says that it is interested in talks, but it is holding to the policy of previous U.S. administrations that the North has to give up its nuclear weapons before it can get any sanctions relief or concessions. And, you know, the North and South are even talking about a formal declaration ending the Korean War, about holding inter-Korean summits, but the U.S. wants no part of that. The U.S. only wants for the North to denuclearize. Then it will think about maybe allowing the two Koreas to have their formal declaration ending the Korean War, to have an inter-Korean summit and a U.S. North Korea summit that really addresses the issue of war on the Korean Peninsula. This is a never-ending war here. It's been going on since 1950, and the two Koreas want to end it. But many experts say the South Koreans are being forced to show a tough stance against North Korea by developing its own submarine-based ballistic missile, for instance.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Jennifer. I've been talking to Jennifer Chang, our correspondent, joining us out of Seoul. The UK government is set to deploy military tanker drivers as panic buying drives petrol pumps and drives up prices. With disruptions to continue possibly for up to a month, if not longer, tensions at gas stations are running high. From London, Saeed Puriza reports.
This is what days of fuel shortage is doing to some people in the UK. Furious at the lack of petrol to fill up their tanks, some motorists are taking it out on each other. Across the country, nerves are frayed. Doctors and essential workers aren't arriving at work on time, and cancer patients have had vital appointments delayed. And with supermarkets, it's meant gaps in restocking shelves. The Prime Minister says the situation is stabilizing. But the dry pumps and lengthy lines of cars at filling stations across major cities mean the crisis hasn't let up just yet, affecting lives and livelihoods.
I've been looking for 3 days now.
Wow.
Yeah, luckily I heard here, so I'm just living down the road.
People can't get to work or schools drop the kids in schools and stuff, but I think it's just a warning lessons in future where I think we have to be probably taking more public transport now because the system is going to take a few days to really get back to normality.
There's no shortage of fuel at refineries, but of truck drivers to transport it to petrol stations. The government here blames it on increased global demand for drivers. Experts say that's not the whole story.
The issues relating to lorry drivers was just one part of this. Some of it is down to the fact that there's a shortage of lorry drivers throughout Europe, but more precisely in the UK, there's a very significant shortage indeed, and there is no instant cure to this. A lot of it is down to the fact that actually the political leadership actually saying don't panic, and unfortunately the net result of that, that's exactly what people do, because they don't trust their politicians.
British soldiers will soon be deployed to drive tankers to replenish empty pumps. Thousands of temporary visas have also been issued for EU drivers to pick up the slack. Haulage companies are offering higher pay rates to lure prospective drivers, but applications have been few and far between.
There's no instant measure of instant coffee or anything like that. You can actually suddenly make something like that. It changes over time. Yes, they can adjust the testing mechanisms. They could try and maybe adjust some of the retirement ages. And they could try and get some people back who may have gone back to Europe. But they're not going to come back on a three-month visa.
Haulage companies, retailers, and petrol stations say the shortfall of drivers is so acute that long queues at petrol stations are going to be a daily occurrence for the foreseeable future, adding to the air of chaos over a host of other issues in the world's fifth largest economy. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Well, that's your war news for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Corporate journalists overwhelmingly leaned on government and military sources, while offering no clear anti-war voices and vanishingly few perspectives from civil society leaders in either Afghanistan or the United States, says Julie Holler, writer, in an article titled Missing Voices in Broadcast Coverage of Afghan Withdrawal. Stay tuned for more. As the U.S., after 20 years, finally began its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the story dominated TV news. Just as they did when the war began, corporate journalists overwhelmingly leaned on government and military sources while offering no clear anti-war voices and vanishingly few perspectives from civil society leaders in either Afghanistan or the United States. Fair studied a week of Afghanistan coverage, starting with the day the Taliban took back Kabul. Fair looked at the three prime-time broadcast news shows, ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and NBC Nightly News, identifying 74 sources across the three shows. Of these sources, 23 sources were Afghans, 20 were identified as Afghan-Americans, and 31% of all sources. Only 11 of these, 23 fewer than half, were identified by at least a first name, and only 4 were women. Afghans often have only one name. While 3 Afghan sources were identified as professionals who might have offered informed commentary on the broader political or historical situation, a journalist, a member of parliament, and a nonprofit director, the vast majority of questions to all Afghan and Afghan-American sources were about their personal risk and situation, essentially providing color rather than expert opinion to the story. Americans who were not Afghans comprised the remaining 51 sources, with no other nationalities represented. Of these U.S. sources, 31 were non-Pentagon government officials, and 16 were current or former military, from the Secretary of Defense to enlisted troops. The remainder were 3 parents of Americans killed in the war, and the non-Afghan U.S. citizens evacuating from Afghanistan. The partisan breakdown of U.S. officials was 29 Democrats to 8 Republicans, with President Joe Biden accounting for 14 of the Democratic sources and other members of his administration accounting for 12. No scholars or anti-war activists from either the U.S. or Afghanistan were featured. Only 2 civil society leaders made appearances: the director of a nonprofit women's organization in Afghanistan and the president of a New York City veterans organization. Despite the media's emphasis on the plight of women in Afghanistan as a result of U.S. withdrawal, women were rarely considered experts or even voices worth hearing on this story. Only 8 sources were female, 11% of the total, 2 of whom were unnamed. And corporate journalists themselves, who have often been the loudest cheerleaders for Afghanistan war, continued their jingoism in the face of the withdrawal. NBC's chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel, for instance, offered an echo of rather than a counterpoint to McConnell and Abdul. A 20-year war, the longest in U.S. history today, ended a disgrace. The U.S. leaving behind a country its citizens are too terrified to live in. Similarly, CBS Nora O'Donnell declared, "When America leaves, for many, so does the hope of freedom, the hope for human rights, and in place comes the sheer terror of what's next." O'Donnell went on to detail the number of Americans killed and wounded, plus the unspecified cost to America's national security. Given that the withdrawal was an acknowledgement that after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. had little control over what kind of country it would be leaving behind, it's hardly to imagine a withdrawal that Engel would not have considered a disgrace. But while he and O'Donnell highlighted the plight of many Afghans, neither made any mention of the number of Afghans killed or wounded in the 20-year war, which was at least 27 times higher than U.S. casualties, according to the Cost of War Project at Brown University. That project estimated that at least 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed, including more than 500 humanitarian workers and journalists, along with over 69,000 national military and police and more than 52,000 opposition fighters. But these tallies, which do not even include the wounded or excess, I mean indirect death, are almost certainly under counts. New Yorker reporter Anand Gopal, who has spent years covering the war, including time in rural Afghanistan, believes that the available death tolls have grossly undercounted civilian casualties, as much of the ongoing conflict has taken place in outlying areas where deaths frequently go unrecorded. Gopal's recent article, New Yorker, on rural Afghan women recounted his investigation in the largely rural Helmand province, where he interviewed a random selection of 12 households, finding that each had lost, on average, 10 to 12 civilians to the war. While the Taliban rule was not popular among those he interviewed, it was clearly preferred to U.S. occupation, which had empowered even more ruthless warlords and ensured unending conflict, airstrikes, and terror in the region. This perspective was not to be found on U.S. TV news coverage of the withdrawal, with its correspondents reporting from the airbase in Kabul and Afghanistan, a world apart from that known by the majority of the country's population. NBC's Lester Holt, who visited Afghanistan in 2010 and 2012, offered a typical assessment, painting the occupation as a sensitive operation bringing Afghanistan out of darkness into a brighter future, saying, "Traveling across Afghanistan a decade into the war in 2012, it was hard not to feel some optimism as if we were witness to a country emerging from darkness. Through the war, epic American-led battles reclaimed cities and villages from the Taliban. U.S. commanders nurtured trust among village elders believing in Afghanistan's future. And now, in the chaos, we are left to wonder how that future has been so rapidly rewritten with the chapters from Afghanistan's past." 2 weeks later, on the eve of the official withdrawal, CBS O'Donnell asked longtime Pentagon correspondent David Martin, "What does this moment mean?" Martin responded, "To me, it's on all of us as American citizens. We as a country could not summon the will to outlast the Taliban. We sent more than 800,000 troops to fight in the war. The vast majority of them did everything we asked of them. They would have gone back for another 20 years if we had asked them. But the country grew tired of the war, and they elected political leaders, both Democratic and Republican, who wanted to end it. History will decide whether that was right or wrong. But either way, Nora, it's on us," unquote. Perspectives of U.S. troops were occasionally presented, but segments featuring veterans' voices seemed largely intended to reassure viewers that the 20-year war was worth it. Some veterans are thinking, was it worth it? Were U.S. sacrifices worth it? O'Donnell said, followed immediately by a soundbite from a veteran. "It was worth it. We gave Afghanistan 2 decades of freedom. It made the world a better place," unquote. Notably, post-9/11 veterans had soured on the war over the past decade. While a 2011 Pew poll found that 50% believed the Afghanistan war had been worth fighting, the outfit's 2019 poll found that the number had dropped to 38%, roughly on par with the general public. Afghanistan veterans were more likely than the general public to support the withdrawal. 58% versus 52%, even after it was well underway and the subject of widespread one-sidedly hostile media coverage in Morning Consult.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us reflect on a bezel of wisdom from Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Sitting with the intelligent is a sign of success. Disputation with other than the disbelievers is a sign of ignorance, while a sign of a scholar is his self-criticism of his sayings and his acquaintance with the various hypotheses.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, 1 hour of justice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Worship is the same relation of creature with creator and possible with necessary, and paying attention to this relation and connection. Those worships are important educational lessons which have an effective role in correcting man's spirit and mind. However, we read in Islamic traditions that 1 hour of justice is better and higher than 1 year of recommended worship. These expressions show the critical importance of justice and mediation, both having a common origin. Wherever there is no justice, there is no thinking, mediation, and wisdom. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, 1 hour of justice is better than 1 year of worship. Brothers and sisters, how many times have we tried to evaluate and introspect on where we are letting go justice from our lives when it comes to our interaction with our families, you know, and it all becomes very frustrating sometimes when we evaluate ourselves. But for our own betterment, we have to do it. Our relationship with our families, our relationship with ourselves, with the society, with the world, and above everything, with Allah, His Messenger, and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. Are we doing justice with what we have? Well, the answer is, we all know that we have shortcomings. So when are we going to start rectifying our lifestyles? Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing 1 hour of justice. And we said Islam has laid a lot of importance on justice and practicing justice in our everyday lives. Sometimes when we think about justice, all we can think about is a courtroom. Well, no. We all are supposed to be acting justly at a given point in time. The Holy Quran considers justice to be a supreme virtue. It is a basic objective of Islam to the degree that it stands next in order of priority to belief in God's exclusive right to worship, which we call Tawheed, and the truth of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his prophethood. In the Islamic worldview, justice denotes placing things in their rightful place. It also means giving others equal treatment, or the treatment that they deserve. In Islam, justice is also a moral virtue and an attribute of human personality. Justice is close to equality in the sense that it creates a state of equilibrium in the distribution of rights and duties, but they're not identical. Sometimes justice is achieved through inequality, like in unequal distribution of wealth. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam declared, "There are 7 categories of people whom God will shelter under His shade on the day when there will be no shade except His. One is the just leader." This is how important justice in Islam is. dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. Most of us know the feeling of being moved by a work of art. Well, a Kosovar artist tries to make us understand a form of political discourse through a mosaic of outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Alkan Bozagur has made a Merkel mosaic from seeds. The artist says he wished to thank the German leader for having been an example for all the women of the world. He says his work is also a tribute to the towering lady for the support she had given to his country, which declared its independence in 2008. Bozagur was doing his work on the same day Germans were voting in the general elections to choose a successor to Merkel. Alkan Bozagur holds two Guinness World Records for his giant mosaics made with seeds.
Wally the Walrus has risen to fame with his extensive travels around Europe. Now the giant mammal has added Iceland to his list of trips. Wally has previously visited France, Spain and the UK. His last known location before Iceland was Ireland. Scientists were not sure at first if they had indeed seen Wally, but Seal Rescue Ireland recognized him from scars on his front flippers. The wandering walrus is 4 years old and weighs about a ton. He has covered a distance of around 5,000 kilometers in his recent trips. Wally is now on his way towards his home in the Arctic. A French zoo has had a very productive year, welcoming multiple new animals into its collection. Two pumas, two jaguars, nine Peruvian squirrel monkeys, and even rarer, macaque twins are new additions to Le Minigny Zoo this summer. The animals were bred as part of a program designed to maintain and promote the conservation of endangered species. Once they reach the breeding age, these animals will be transported to other zoos to help boost the population of their species.
Now, a museum in Russia's Kaliningrad has unveiled a special exhibition to the public. It would not be exactly wrong to call the artworks out of trash. All the works exhibited are made of rubbish. The exhibition is showcasing a wide array of objects, including sculptures, musical instruments, robots, and costumes. The project was designed with the aim of raising awareness about recycling. People visiting the exhibition were delighted by the creative use of garbage.
Only 7% of waste is recycled in Russia each year, while a vast amount of trash is stored in landfills.
An Egyptian artist is making incredibly tiny statues of famous historical figures and landmarks on pencil tips. 30-year-old Ibrahim Balala is based in the city of Rashid, south of Cairo. He has mastered the art of crafting miniature sculptures. Ibrahim mostly creates statues of Egyptian pharaohs, but Islamic, Greek, and Roman figures also feature in his portfolio. The artist received some criticism when he first ventured on his art, but he persevered and rose to prominence with his minuscule statues. Ibrahim's dream is to open a museum of miniature sculptures someday.
Fourteen lucky penguins have been returned to the seas off the Atlantic coast of Argentina after rehabilitating them from malnutrition and hypothermia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the chilly waters once they were released. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists in February. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile.
Another groundbreaking archaeological discovery in Peru is now catching attention. 800-year-old human remains south of the capital, Lima, highlight the ancient burial rituals in the South American country. The remains of 8 adults and children buried in a common tomb were found by a group of workers laying gas pipes at the site. They were buried with food, dishes, and musical instruments, including flutes. Archaeologists say that the 8 people lived in the ancient town of Chitka, some 60 kilometers from Lima. They say some of the bodies were buried with the shells on their heads and had bags with cocoa leaves inside them. They say the discovery will shed more light on the pre-Hispanic history of the region. Another 30 human remains had been discovered in Chilca in 2018.
A taxi company in Thailand has turned its vehicles into mini vegetable gardens to help its drivers who are out of work due to the coronavirus pandemic.
The point of this project is so that employees have something to do to reduce stress. To a certain extent, it has helped with reducing our stress, but it isn't really the answer to the situation right now. Even though the drivers and the staff are able to harvest the vegetables for food, it's just part of solving the problem. I think the government should also step in to help us too.
The taxi company is growing vegetables on the roofs and hoods of 300 disused taxis that are parked idly. Prolonged COVID-19 lockdowns have affected the drivers' income negatively so that they are unable to pay the lease of their vehicles. Therefore, working in these gardens has reduced their stress and provided the drivers and their families with food.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Amongst the thousands of shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar lies a tiny tea house with a long history that attracts visitors with its famous treats. Haj Ali Darvish Tea House is the smallest and oldest tea house in the Iranian capital. The 2-meter-wide cafe belongs to 63-year-old Kazem Maputian, who took over the century-old business from his father. He serves a wide range of teas, but its signature is the tea of kindness, a mixture of mint, lemon, and saffron. His tea house is the most famous in Tehran, serving some 200 customers every day. It used to be a tourist attraction before the coronavirus pandemic. Haj Ali Darvish Tea House was enlisted as Iran's intangible cultural heritage in 2016. Farmers working on the border between Venezuela and Colombia have discovered a tusk that is believed to belong to an American mastodon from 16,000 years ago.
We went to the place and the fossil was there, and then we realized it was something very important. We rescued it because there was a risk of it being lost, and at this moment, it's in the Archaeological and Paleontological Museum of Agualinda.
The experts say the discovery would help them with complementing information about extinct animals and ancient settlements. They say the finding of the tusk in the site would increase its potential contribution to scientific researchers. The discovery of mega faunal fossils in South America has been common over the past decades. In 2019, more than 800 mammoth bones were discovered near Mexico. A group of Cambodian students has designed a manned drone in an attempt to beat traffic. The drone has eight propellers and a school chair for the pilot's seat. It can carry a human weighing up to 60 kilograms. The creative students say the drone is still in its early stages of development and testing. Equipped with four batteries, the human carrier drone can fly up to 4 meters and around 10 minutes above the ground.
Here we have big problems related to traffic jams, so we did some research about this before building the drone. We came up with this drone project as we had the idea that we wanted to solve some problems for our society by making a drone taxi, as well as investing drones for firefighters to help put out fires.
The prototype can or has cost around $20,000 to build. The designers say they need 2 more years to complete the project. The school has expressed hope that the drone could be used in everyday life.
Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted an art show themed with Aspiration for Peace. Organized by the Economic Cooperation Organization, the event seeks to shed light on the beauty of a global peace through the language of art. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Each one of these delicate works of art are created by an artist from a different country, each trying a unique way to highlight the need for lasting peace in the world. Dubbed Aspiration for Peace, the art gallery is organized by Eco Cultural Institute with the aim of promoting global peace through the language of art.
By holding this event, we want to send a message of peace to all countries. We invited diplomats from all embassies here to gather and unite and celebrate a peaceful gathering. Also, the artworks showcased here are created by artists from various countries, and this represents how beautiful it is for nations to live peacefully.
Art helps connect different civilizations and nations. It helps us bridge the cultural gaps and find commonalities. This will establish mutual understanding and harmony among nations, and therefore conflicts can be avoided.
In some of the artworks, images immediately communicate with the audience, even if faces are veiled. These pictures try to narrate the story of Afghan women and an uncertain future that they're facing amid the Taliban's takeover of power in Afghanistan.
The events that are taking place in my country, Afghanistan, are so painful. It might take hours to tell you how hard it is for an Afghan girl to live in insecurity and uncertainty. But through the language of art, you can understand all these words without the need for translation.
The art show was held on the occasion of the International Day of Peace. Observed every year on September 21st, the occasion was introduced by the UN General Assembly as a chance to strengthen the ideals of peace through observing 24 hours of nonviolence and ceasefire.
A picture is worth a thousand words, and indeed, no words can be as strong as the strokes of an artist in speaking the beauty of peace. And this is how the universal language of art transcends the political and cultural boundaries and touches the hearts of viewers, no matter what language they speak. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
French slackliner has wowed watching crowds in Paris by crossing from the Eiffel Tower to the other side of the River Seine. Nathan Poulain walked across a rope suspended 17 meters above the ground. He finished the 600-meter course in half an hour. On one point, he sat and lay on the rope before arriving at his destination, the Chaillot Theater. The 27-year-old daredevil practiced 4 years to perform this show. Poulain said that he was staying focused during the walk, and that was very challenging.
When I was young, I had fear of heights, and I learned to contain it. During the performance, I really didn't feel it. I really didn't have that problem. I felt some stress over starting it, but no vertigo, no.
Poulain said that it was an uneasy experience, but he was happy to share it with the public. The athlete started slacklining 10 years ago. In 2019, he performed a 510-meter-long walk between two skyscrapers in Paris.
Visitors and keepers of a zoo in the Peruvian capital, Lima, are thrilled over the birth of 8 baby penguins from the vulnerable Humboldt species. Zookeepers say the chicks were hatched in July and they're expecting 6 more additions later in October. Currently, the newborns spend their days resting in their nests and being fed by their parents. The Huachipa Zoo currently has 42 Humboldt penguins and is working on recovering the species population.
We have 8 2-month-old chicks and 6 eggs. In 42 days, those eggs will hatch and the chicks will come out. The important thing about Humboldt penguins is that we are recovering their population because they are in a vulnerable state. We are increasing their populations with the breeding we are doing in the zoo.
Researchers say a maximum of less than 10,000 Humboldt penguins are left in the wild, with their population size undergoing extreme fluctuations. The species face emerging threats from agricultural activities to their own vulnerability to predators. The Humboldt penguins are only found along the Pacific coast of Chile and Peru and are enlisted as threatened species by the International Union for Conservation of Nature.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A recent announcement from the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor saying his office is seeking approval to resume its investigation into potential war crimes in Afghanistan committed by the Taliban and Daesh, but excluding atrocities committed by U.S. forces, sparked a flurry of outrage from human rights defenders. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanes, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Critics Fume as ICC Excludes U.S. from Probe into Afghan War Crimes. Stay tuned for more. recent announcement from the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, saying his office is seeking approval to resume its investigation into potential war crimes in Afghanistan committed by the Taliban and Daesh, but excluding atrocities committed by the United States forces, sparked a flurry of outrage from human rights defenders. It seems there is no end to the betrayal of Afghans. Now, so many victims of torture and other abuses by the United States and former Afghan government forces have been told there is no justice for you. Patricia Gossman, Associate Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, tweeted recently in response to the announcement. The International Criminal Court, ICC, on March 5, 2020, overturned its previous decision and authorized then-Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda to formally probe crimes as far back as 2002 committed by members of U.S. armed forces, the CIA, the Taliban, affiliated armed groups, and some government forces. It would also have covered crimes committed at so-called CIA black sites in Poland, Lithuania, and Romania. The prospect of the probe elicited fierce backlash from the Trump administration, which slapped retaliatory sanctions on Bensouda and other top ICC officials. Investigation was deterred last year, however, when the Afghan government in March sought to take on the investigation itself. But given the significant changes of the circumstances in Afghanistan, including the absent prospect of adequate and effective proceedings to be carried out by Afghan authorities, current ICC prosecutor Karim Khan said in a statement recently, a resumed investigation carried out by the ICC is warranted. At the same time, Khan pointed to the limited resources available to my office relative to the scale and nature of crimes within the jurisdiction of the court that are being or have been committed in various parts of the world as motivating his decision to narrow the scope of the Afghan probe to crimes allegedly committed by the Taliban and Daesh and to deprioritize other aspects of this investigation. The gravity, scale, and continuing nature of alleged crimes by the Taliban and Daesh, which include allegations of indiscriminate attack on civilians, targeted extrajudicial executions, persecution of women and girls, crimes against children, and other crimes affecting the civilian population at large, demand focus on proper sources from my office, he said. Continuing, if we are to construct credible cases capable of being proved beyond reasonable doubt in the courtroom. Khan's announcement drew criticism from Catherine Gallagher, a human rights attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is representing victims in the ICC investigation into the situation in Afghanistan. In a recent tweet thread, Gallagher wrote that she was stunned and only found out about the development from Khan's public press statement, despite meeting with prosecutor's office about why it should prioritize investigation of U.S. torture, war crimes, and crimes against humanity that were committed or feathered on scores of member states' territories for a decade.